Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lighten. This is Open Source, taking a short course this hour on what looks like a life-saving molecule inside those COVID vaccines coming soon to a clinic near you. The active agent in the vaccine is nature's own RNA, the messenger mate of DNA, which holds the code of life in a molecular form. It's RNA that delivers the coded message that structures the proteins that make every living thing. At the head of the race for COVID vaccines, what the trial runs establish, and in record time, is that modified mRNA fires up a defense system inside your body that fights off the COVID virus in the great majority of tests. Before this hour is done, we will tap into the crystalline 60-year-old memory of the legendary biologist Matthew Meselson. Back in 1960, he couldn't see that messenger molecule, but he wrote a historic paper saying it had to be there, and he called it RNA. We begin with the young scientist entrepreneur who brought it to market and built his company, Moderna Therapeutics, around it. Derek Rossi is a stem cell biologist and a Renaissance man at age 54. He grew up working class in Canada with family roots in Malta. He went to school at the University of Toronto and went to Finland for his PhD. He's an ice hockey nut and a collector of Moby Dick first editions in many languages. Derek Rossi has been up close and personal with mRNA for more than a decade.
To understand where mRNA fits in the scheme of life and, you know, in the setting of COVID vaccines and mRNA therapeutics, you have to know where it fits in the cellular life of every cell in our body and every cell of everybody's body. And that's really critical to understanding mRNA.
Can I quote the doctrine you've taught me, that DNA makes RNA, makes protein, makes life?
Yeah.
Almost as simple or complicated as that.
I think it's really the place to start. Everybody listening to your show has heard about DNA. DNA is in the vocabulary of everybody on planet Earth, I would say. mRNA is not. But we have to start with DNA. So DNA is the genetic code of life. I think everybody knows that. But what they don't really realize is that DNA sits in the nucleus of our cell and actually is a pretty passive molecule. It doesn't do too much. Hmm. When it sits in the nucleus, it doesn't actually actively participate in the functioning of the cell. It holds the code. It's all there. But the code needs to be read and turned into something that is actually active. Hmm. That something is actually proteins. The only problem is that proteins are made in the cytoplasm and the DNA sits in the nucleus, and those are totally different cellular compartments. And to sort of get the code read from DNA, there's this intermediate molecule called messenger mRNA. It reads the code verbatim. It is also a nucleic acid. Both DNA and mRNA are nucleic acids. They're very similar. DNA is double-stranded, mRNA is single-stranded. But basically, when the mRNA is made, it is a faithful replication of the code sequence that's contained on the DNA.
Right.
It has the ability to migrate out of the nucleus where the DNA lives, and it moves to the cytoplasm, which is the site of protein synthesis. And its code now is read in an organelle called the ribosome to make the proteins, which are the active molecules of life.
This is too elementary, but I picture it as a sort of messenger on a horse riding across the plain, sort of the Pony Express, saying, I've got the news, I've got the instructions, here it is, and you need it.
Unless you had that messenger, unless that code was able to be read from the DNA, DNA would be non-functional, other than, you know, passing on heredity. But you really need to read the code for DNA to do anything, all the machinations of life. And to do that, you need the messenger. The messenger needs to deliver the code, to carry the code and deliver the code and have it read. And that's what messenger RNA is. So you see it as a, you know, a horse riding out of the nucleus. You could if you wish, but it's but it's certainly the molecule that brings the message into a form that's readable and readable meaning turned into something that's functional in the cell, which is the proteins that it encodes.
Derek Rossi, you're one of the few guys who read the breakthrough paper about mRNA, I think, what, 2005. Most of the scientific world sort of turned the page and forgot it. You saw opportunity. It was the promise of therapeutic use. Can you explain all that?
You're referring to the work of Carrico and Weissman at UPenn, and they had published a really important study that, as you said, got sort of largely overlooked by the scientific community, where they basically described the ability of modified versions of the building blocks of RNA. Those building blocks are called nucleosides, so modified nucleosides, to enter the cell and sort of slip back past the normal sort of recognition mechanisms that the cell has to ward off viral infection, quite frankly. Their discovery allowed the creation of synthetic mRNA that would be able to slip into the cell, get past sort of antiviral mechanisms.
Right.
And instead of getting the code now from the DNA and, you know, the messenger carrying it to the cytoplasm, to the ribosome for proteins to be made, now you can deliver the mRNA from outside the cell into the cell, have it accepted by the cell, and again, have it do what mRNA does, which is go to the ribosome, encode a protein that then has a functional attribute. In this case, it's the spike protein of coronavirus. That's the code they carry.
This was the stealth delivery piece, and important.
Yeah, that's right. Yep.
So what did you think you could do with it besides start a company and call it Moderna?
The first thought, not at all, was to start a company. We started working on it to solve a biological question that we were working on, and we used it as a workaround, actually. So we started working on it in 2008, mRNA, to make very powerful embryonic stem cell-like cells using mRNA. And standard off-the-shelf textbook mRNA would not work, because when we went to introduce it into cells, it looked like a foreign invading virus, and the cells responded with an antiviral response, which killed a lot of cells in the dish, quite frankly.
Mm-hmm.
And the Carrico and Weissman discovery, we thought to apply it to the synthesis of mRNA with the idea that we might be able to get that mRNA into the cell in a stealth mode, in other words, not recognized by the antiviral machinery of the cell, and rather what really we wanted was to send the mRNA into the cell and have it, you know, make the proteins that we were trying to encode for this project we were doing on stem cell biology. And it worked, and it worked robustly. And then we made, you know, many, many dozens of proteins via modified RNAs in the lab. And it was really, you know, after we had made maybe the 10th or 15th or 20th different modified mRNA protein, I realized that essentially we could make any protein with modified mRNA using these modified building blocks that Carrico and Weissman had discovered, which are actually naturally occurring in the cell to begin with. They're in every cell of your body. And after we had made so many different proteins, I thought, well, if we could bring this to an in vivo setting, we had done all our work in the setting of cells in a dish, but if we could bring it into animals and show that we could use this technology in animals to affect some sort of therapeutic outcome, that would be transformational. Because remember, you said it, DNA makes mRNA, makes protein, makes life. Well, DNA mutation makes bad mRNA, makes bad protein, makes disease pathology.
Derek, make the case as you have to me that Catalin Carrico deserves the Nobel Prize for what this molecule was celebrating.
Well, I've said that, yeah, because it's a fundamental discovery without which we might not have mRNA therapeutics. I mean, somebody eventually might have come across this. Some point down the road, it happens in science that eventually everything is discovered. But the fact of the matter is, they made the key discovery, published this paper, which we read, and like you said, had sort of disappeared out of the literature. Nobody was paying much attention to it, but we sort of revived it and, you know, had great success with it. It went on to form Moderna. That was very successful. BioNTech licensed the technology as well. We don't have these medicines. We don't have COVID vaccines right now without that discovery made in 2005.
Long before COVID, Derek, some people thought, aha, this will confront cancer in a new way. Do we still feel that way?
So wherever you have your finger on, you know, one of the key levers of life, DNA, RNA, or protein, you have the ability to intervene in any aspect of life. And cancer is one aspect. And there's a lot of actually activity, you know, in the pipelines of these companies looking at cancer vaccines to prompt cells to mount a more aggressive immune response against their own cancer cells. This is the thing that's farthest along in the clinic. But I would argue that really any aspect of life that's, you know, mediated by proteins, which is most aspects of the machinations of the cell and the machinations of life, is potentially an area that mRNA therapeutics could intervene upon.
Science is on an incredible high with mRNA and this vaccine. Applications for medical school, way up. Science as a career, way up. What would you love to do with this moment?
Oh, that's exciting. Well, the first thing I'd love to do is educate the public on some really fundamental aspects of science. What's incredible to me is how little the public understands about what actually a vaccine is. So I often spend some time talking about what vaccines actually do. And then they say, well, you know, but the mRNA, how does that fit into the whole picture? And I, you know, point out that, well, vaccination is one thing, and that's a science unto itself, and it's a proven science. It's really important for human health. I mean, it has eradicated diseases from the face of the earth. I give you smallpox, you know, the first disease that was eradicated with a vaccine. So it's a good opportunity for us to learn about vaccination, how it works, and to learn about the fundamental sort of mechanisms of life. You know, like I said, DNA is sort of in everybody's lexicon. It's, you know, you talk to anybody around the planet, they've heard the word DNA. Essentially, nobody has heard the word mRNA unless you happen to be a biologist. It's wonderful now that mRNA is becoming a household word, a kitchen table word. I think it's really important still for everybody to understand what it is and what it does and how they work. Similarly, protein. It's amazing to me, people don't know what protein is, how important protein is for life. People think protein is something they eat. So generally speaking, I see this as just a wonderful moment in time to educate the public about some really wonderful fundamentals of biology.
Coming up, more Derek Rossi and a COVID surge in vocations to do medical science. This is Open Source. mRNA to the rescue this hour. Inside the thundercloud of pandemic disease and therapeutic innovation, we are in Fred Ledley Mindspace. Dr. Ledley has practiced pediatric medicine and run a number of biomedical startups. At Bentley University outside Boston, he has done a number of case studies of scientific studies that do or don't return public benefits. This matter of mRNA biology and the COVID vaccine, Fred Ledley says, will stand as a landmark.
This is like any other drug you take. You're going to have a shot, that molecule will do what it's supposed to in the body, and then it will be eliminated and you are hopefully no worse for wear. A couple of things about this were particularly great for vaccines. The first is, because of the way this is made, in essence, once the virus was discovered, once the genetic sequence of that virus was known, which was the second week of January, a company like Moderna had the ability to essentially, within 24 or 48 hours, take a piece of that genetic sequence that they recognized was going to be important and almost literally punch that code into a machine and get a molecule out the other side that they could begin testing. Now, that's not a product. It's only, you know, minuscule amounts. But you can begin working with it. You can begin optimizing it. You can begin understanding it. And conventional drugs are not like that. Conventional drugs, you have to do a huge amount of work up front to produce the product, to understand its physical characteristics, to purify it, so that there's an innate delay of many months or even years before you actually have the molecule that you want to test.
It's another vote here, I think, for the ultimate prize to go to the Chinese doctor who put the genome of this virus on the World Wire on January 10th. All over the world, biologists could read it like a book the next day and start working on it.
So kudos to that scientist, obviously, but this is what we do in the modern world. This is the legacy of genomics. For those who remember the great excitement about the ability to sequence an organism only 20 years ago, it's now absolutely routine when you go looking for a virus to immediately go looking for that genome, because that tells you everything you need to know about the virus. That tells you what the vaccine has to look like. It's going to tell you what drugs are likely to impact that virus. That's how a drug like remdesivir was actually identified within days of the virus being discovered. So yes, this is incredibly powerful tools we have to not just say, oh, I think there's a virus. Yes, it will transmit from person to person, but actually have that fingerprint that will allow us to exactly identify that virus and know so much about how it works.
Fred, come to the Moderna labs in Cambridge, forever linked to mRNA, because they were named for mRNA. Modified RNA gave Moderna its name. A company that has never before this delivered a consumer product, but it's the richest biotech company in the world. How did it get there?
Moderna's made a huge investment in messenger RNA, and that has been their entire focus since they were founded in 2010. And they were founded with a couple of different technologies that you need to bring together to make this work. One is you have to understand the biology, and they have outstanding biologists. But also you have to be able to get this molecule into human cells. But just floating around in the blood isn't enough. So they also had to do what in drug science is called delivery. How do you actually deliver that molecule, this messenger RNA, into a cell so it can work its magic? It brought together scientists from a couple of universities, but also from disciplines, from fields as different as medicine and pharmaceutics and physical chemistry, really, to solve that challenge. And they've taken the technology very far. They've done this with the expectation that this technology was very generalizable and might work for many, many different indications. They've raised a lot of money for it. They've been very successful. And high on their list are a number of vaccines, because the vaccines require very little of this foreign material to be produced. Your immune system takes that signal, just that exposure to a piece of a virus, particularly when that piece of a virus is made in a human cell. Without getting technical, the way viruses work is they put their genetic material into your cells, and that's what your body recognizes really well, when your cell is doing something it's not supposed to. Whereas a conventional vaccine is just injecting some foreign material into your body, it also needs other things with it to sort of ramp up your immune system. The RNA vaccines don't. That this is a very natural way to present a piece of a virus to your immune system. Your immune system is really good at recognizing things in that context and saying, this doesn't belong here. I'm going to mount an immune response. And I think that's what you're seeing. I think the tremendous success of the Moderna vaccines and the Pfizer vaccines is testimony to this being exactly the right modality for developing a vaccine.
Fred, the Moderna company and flagship, which owns it, is innovating financially as well as scientifically. Nubar Afeyan is at the top of flagship. He's an MIT biology PhD, but he's also doing something different in the organization here. That's not a faculty of scientists. It's sort of a corporation with scientists. What's different in that?
So this is not only a company doing innovative science. This is a very innovative business. No one's ever really done exactly what they did. They went out and raised over $1 billion of what's called venture capital. This is money from private investors that's 10 times or more than most companies raise in their early years. That gave them a basis to be very expansive in their thinking, to, for example, invest in the manufacturing and things that many startup companies can't afford and can't begin to pioneer, but eventually do take a great deal of investment. They had one of the biggest, what's called the initial public offering ever, which is when they take their shares and they offer them to citizens on a public exchange, in this case, the NASDAQ exchange. And the company, as late as May, had raised about $3 or $4 billion and had a valuation of about $30 billion.
But what was the lure, or what was the guarantee? What made it so attractive without a product? And what did it matter that they thought they might be on the way to a cancer cure?
I think the long-term goal of Moderna was not vaccines. It was very much treatment for cancer, including something called a cancer vaccine, which is sort of a hybrid between the types of vaccines we're talking about today, where you're trying to recognize something that originated in a virus, to trying to get your immune system to recognize a cancer cell as something that doesn't belong in your body, and to sort of marshal the power of the immune system to destroy that cancer cell. This is a very important theoretical approach to cancer. It's had some success in recent years. And the thought was that technologies like messenger RNA might take that approach to cancer therapy over the line. That still remains a goal for Moderna. Moderna has a lot of those products still listed in development, but the same technology is applicable for things like antiviral vaccines, as we're talking about today. They've also attacked some of my very favorite diseases. It's a little bit odd to have a favorite disease, but I trained in pediatrics and took care of many children with inherited diseases. And Moderna is developing therapies for some of the diseases where I've seen what havoc this can wreak in a young person's life. So this type of approach has many applications, and that's what attracted investors to Moderna. This is an offense which is highly diverse, is going to take a lot of shots. Not everything's going to work. We know a lot of things do not work in drug development. The investors saw it as a benefit to be able to take several shots on goal and have several chances to win.
Fred Ludley, the profits here are going to be fantastic, including the incredible climb in the price of the stock. What's your own citizen take as a doctor, as a businessman, about who they owe and where these profits should be reinvested?
So this is a complicated question. We know that even before Moderna, the government invested billions of dollars in research aimed at using not only RNA, but also DNA and other nucleic acids as therapeutic molecules, as things that could be administered to people to treat disease. And in general, that's the role of government. People describe it as the investor of first resort, to sort of do that very experimental, sometimes without knowing how it might be applied, research, which we call basic research. And without that, nothing else happens. Not all of that gets captured in patents. Sometimes patents can be licensed and the public gets paid back. But more often, what academic scientists do is they publish the results, they describe them in meetings, they make every effort to be sure that the benefits of federal science are generally available to the public. While Moderna's put a lot of money into this, even before COVID, even before the BARDA money and the billion-dollar contracts to provide vaccines, there's been a big investment. Shareholders have also put a lot of money in. And really, the unease people have with the involvement of private companies in this, to our mind, is really what happens to the profits. In the scientific community, we really want those profits to be plowed back into research, in which case this is really a win-win. This builds successful companies. Companies like Vertex are still investing their earnings back into their research. Companies like Amazon are investing all of their profits, or the vast majority of their profits, back into building better and better products and expanding their product offerings. Where people get very concerned is where those profits are siphoned off directly to the shareholders.
Well, and in some cases at Moderna, high scientists in the company have cashed in on their stock profits already. And people wondered, huh?
So there are issues of equity for sure. And the question of whether the stock that the people have, and many of these people got stock for their work in the company. In our view, we're a little bit less worried about people profiting from their stock than the distribution of the profits. The stock of a company is largely speculative. From this point on, it's very unlikely people who continue to buy Moderna stock are actually investing in the research. What they're doing is investing in the stock itself. So there's the early investors in Moderna. Much of that cash went to the research. That's not true once companies have the type of valuation that Moderna has. Mm. You really would like to see this continue, this profit, which is largely coming from the government at this point, right? It's a government contract to buy the vaccines. Going forward, it's still likely the government will have a major role funding the vaccines as well as other public health measures. The distribution of those resources out of the ecosystem, out of the continued innovation for better and better products, better and better healthcare, is of particular concern.
Fred, what's the message going forward and the model for this work in the future? Used to be, till recently, people worried that vaccines couldn't be financed. There was not a payoff for life-saving medicine. What's the takeaway from this almost accidental collision of a pandemic, a molecule, and a company?
So this is a unique, we hope this is a unique point in time, right? What you're trying to do here is stem a tremendous amount of human suffering, which is only going to get worse around the world in the next year. In terms of the United States, we've lost about one third as many people already from COVID as we lost in the great pandemic of 1918, which is the classic worst case scenario.
Yeah, and about half the deaths in our Civil War.
And we're right up there with American losses in the wars of this past half century, if not the wars of the whole last century. So one can't exaggerate the degree of human suffering that's going on at the moment. I don't even think in the United States we're quite aware of how this is impacting South America, how it has the potential to impact Africa and places where we are very concerned about the adequacy of our response, but there are places that are not going to be able to mount even the response that we have. So this is a point in time where the government did exactly the right thing to step in at a huge level. Any expense that the government undertakes in bringing this to an end is well justified, not only on a humanitarian basis, but also on an economic basis. The economies of the world are losing trillions of dollars of commerce, of jobs, of employment, of young people's lives that they're going to have to catch up in their education or their employment and their knowledge. So this is exactly the right thing for the government to do. You would hope that in the future we're a little bit smarter and we do it before there's a crisis. This crisis was not unforeseen. The World Health Organization has a list of pandemic threats. And it's people have been pushing for decades to be aware of where the threats may come from and be alert to jumping on it faster, but also preemptively developing products. That's where this is going to get very tricky, because that's the point at which there's not going to be a huge payback for vaccines. So it's very important that not only the government stays engaged, but also that industry takes some of the profits that they're getting from this and they reinvest that in preventing the next epidemics. It's not unforeseen where these can come from. You hope if you're on top of it and you make enough investment and you anticipate enough, maybe there'll never be a problem. And maybe people will not make a lot of money, but you'll prevent the human suffering of a pandemic that gets out of control like this. So we really do hope that this moment in time doesn't just come to an end when the vaccine is available and the pandemic begins to wane, but not only the lessons, but the economics of this are now applied to prevent the next one.
Fred, I associate you with the Center for Integration of Science and Industry. What got you started before COVID, and what's your next assignment?
You know, the best way to get things done in our society is to find the powerful synergies between the public and the private sector. As I was talking about, the NIH has such a critical role and makes such a substantial investment in all this great science. And we do depend on the private sector to take that science and create public value from it. Public value in terms of better health, public value in terms of better jobs, public value in terms of affluence and economic activity. These are all things we consider very important in our society. Sometimes they're not synergized. Sometimes they're really in conflict, that the desire for excess profit can compromise what's best for healthcare. Sometimes the need for jobs in certain parts of the world or certain parts of the country, there's tremendous competition to bring jobs into rural areas. So finding the right balance where you create as much public value as possible, we think, requires a better understanding of some of the dynamics of the system and better ways to intervene. So we're very involved. We want to be sure the drugs that are being developed are really addressing the burden of disease. We want to be sure that they are stimulating the commerce required to bring those to people. But we also want to be sure that everybody can afford those drugs and that they're very widely available. It's a very difficult balance.
Fred Dudley, I'm so glad we found you. Thank you.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Chris.
Coming up, Matthew Meselson's 6 decades watching mRNA grow up. This is Open Source. We're back to Derek Rossi's version of the story. He's the biologist who named his company Moderna in honor of modified RNA and got the Italian word for modern in the bargain. He's telling us one man's story of what drives scientists and how their passion gets paid for. I'd love to hear you talking about this scientific search. It's all over the place. It's not one eureka. It's not exactly heroic. There are slips made. Great clues get missed. It's an inclusive process. World figures.
There's so many brilliant people around the planet working on really interesting aspects of biology, largely in the name of discovery. The true scientist basically works for the purpose of making discoveries of something that was previously unknown. Mm. I think all humans can relate to that concept. It's what makes the job one of the best jobs on the planet.
You know, we're still absorbing this kind of miracle and don't understand it. Can I just say,
yeah,
I'm interested in the human qualities that brought us to this point, including, of course, scientific talent and genius, but also persistence and cooperation, competition, also government money, private money. This is a complex story. In the Carrico case particularly, this was a real testing of a person's courage, persistence, self-confidence. Speak of the human qualities in this breakthrough, including your own.
Any scientist will tell you this. You go to answer a question, you're trying to answer a question you want the answer to, and you're lucky if it's a straight path and an easy path. More often than not, you hit walls. It's just the way science is. You come to a technical hurdle that you can't get through, or, you know, your hypothesis is proven incorrect. There are so many challenges. A very good scientist has a success rate or a hit rate on anything they try of, you know, 10, 20%. But most of it is actually failure. The one thing I used to tell my graduate students is that you're going to hit walls in science all the time. There's two things you can do. You can either retreat and go down another path and pursue another project, or you can try to think about how you're going to get through that wall. And one way to get through the wall is the thing that I used to tell my grad students is you can chew your way through the wall. No matter how big the wall, no matter what composition it's made of, it could be a 5-foot concrete wall. If you're persistent enough, you can actually chew your way through that wall. And I think that that's actually what Kati Kariko did in her work. It actually didn't catch the imagination of the scientific press or pharma or biotech, and it sort of disappeared. We hit a wall in what we were doing, and somebody had already dug through that wall with their teeth. And we found it in the literature, and we applied it to the issue that we were using, which allowed us to get to our goal. But at the same time, I realized, as Kathy and Drew did, that this could potentially have application for therapeutics.
I got to ask you, are the rewards in this game appropriate in the sense that, you know, the value of Moderna has skyrocketed? I mean, 6, 8, 10 times in this year, billions and billions of dollars of value. Is it a sane way to make a vaccine, to find the vaccine, but also, is it fair?
Is it fair? That's a pretty loaded question.
Fair to scientists, fair to the thousands that are struggling and their papers haven't been read yet or have been neglected.
I wouldn't phrase it in terms of fairness or not. It's just how science goes. Your satisfaction as a scientist, your goal is to publish papers, to get your work out there, to finish your study, to answer an important question, to get your paper published, and to have your peers read it and hopefully appreciate it. And by the way, build upon it. You know, that's the currency of academia. That's what satisfies a scientist. Getting your study published is really what scientists seek to do. It makes us happy to publish papers, quite frankly. The more papers you publish, the higher impact they have, the more successful your career is, typically. You know, to dream that all scientific discoveries are going to lead to CRISPR or modified mRNA therapeutics is unrealistic because they don't. That happens sometimes. It's rare that something big like that, you know, it's probably once a decade. But, you know, 99.9% of discoveries are made in the interests of our human brain's desire to understand the unknown and to ask scientific questions and get an answer. And that, generally speaking, is satisfying enough to a scientist.
Do we credit COVID in some weird reverse sense for accelerating this whole process?
Absolutely. Yeah, both BioNTech and, you know, Moderna has 20-odd programs in clinical development, some of which are in phase one, some of which are in phase two, some of which are in preclinical studies. And these will make their way through these clinical trials, but typically to, you know, go from phase one to phase three for your standard off-the-shelf medicine, and in this case, a new, you know, mRNA therapeutic, is a many-year process, a many, many-year process, a hundred of millions of dollar process. What this pandemic did, though, was turn that on its head. And it did so because of just the necessity of responding to the level of virulence that this virus was showing and its infectivity. I mean, just look at the numbers. It's absolutely staggering.
Right.
62 plus million people around the planet infected, and it's probably many, many more than that. So what was shown this year, which is absolutely incredible, and again, this technology was in part, at least the mRNA technology, there's a reason that the first two vaccines to make it to on the cusp of emergency approval are mRNA vaccines. It's because of the speed with which you can deploy this technology.
Right.
That's just true. But the fact that we did a phase one, phase two, and phase three trial all within a year is really, I don't know for sure, but I'll imagine that it's unprecedented.
What is the model unfolding here about financing vaccines, financing modern medicine? I mean, Moderna had warp speed money from the federal government here. Also, it's been heavily supported by private investment. Do we see a way forward here in financing advanced science and medicine?
This is typically what runs biotech, and that model is pretty well established. There's an enormous amount of biotech investment that successfully leads to new drugs. Typically what happens is that when it gets into late stage clinical trials, phase two or phase three, it catches the attention of big pharma, and big pharma makes a partnership and injects money and or buys the asset or the company outright. So the financial model for the development of new drugs is pretty well established.
But nobody's particularly happy with it, either the results heretofore, but also the boom. Big Pharma is not a magic name in public life.
Yeah, well, I think that that's a bit of a branding issue. You know, it's a political hot potato, but I think that the level of sophistication that politicians bring to thinking about these issues is not very high. And explaining it to the general public is difficult. So generally speaking, making new medicines is very, very expensive business. To get anybody to put their money on the line to pay for that, they have to have the possibility of financial reward on the other end. It's called capitalism. That's how it works. If you were to take that away, you are not going to get the early investment that you need to make new medicines, and the development of new medicines will grind to a halt.
Derek Rice, we live to learn, and we're very, very grateful for your feeding us. Thank you.
Always fun talking with you, Chris. I enjoyed it.
From the first week in March this year, Naheed Bhadelia has been eyes and ears for us in the clinical experience of the COVID onslaught. She teaches infectious diseases at the Boston University School of Medicine, and she runs the Special Pathogens Unit at the Boston Medical Center. I asked her this week about the new tech and science that's coming online in this month-to-month emergency.
The mRNA technology is actually really exciting, and it's not just exciting right now for the COVID-19 pandemic, but it's exciting because, you know, we've been sort of looking at this technology for 10 years now, and one of the issues has been stabilizing it so that you're able to deliver those instructions to the cell to make the kind of protein that you want so you can have the immune response. And the studies that with the mRNA vaccines for COVID-19 have been sort of a, you know, the proof is in the pudding. Looks like that technology works, and it's important not just for this pandemic, but because it is a technology that's much quicker to work with, much easier to manufacture. You know, it only took a matter of weeks from the moment that China shared the genetic information to the first person who was part of the trials to get a mRNA vaccine. It's that easy. It's a plug-and-play technology, which means in a world where we're going to see increasing number of pandemics appear, knowing that this technology works puts another weapon in our arsenal in the future to potentially turn around a vaccine much more quickly.
First thought was it was going to be aimed at cancer. You do infectious diseases of a great variety. Where would you use it? What can it do?
Well, for infectious diseases, the great thing about this is that if we have shown, as we've shown with these COVID studies, right, and if they pan out, if you can show that you, if, as long as you know what part of the virus you're interested in targeting and creating immunity against, right? That's part of the science that we need to know. And we lucked out here because we had some knowledge of what part of SARS-CoV-2, the COVID-19 virus, we wanted to focus on from studies that we had done with MERS and SARS. And so if, as long as you have an idea what your target would be, what I'm hoping mRNA vaccine technology will do is, as exactly as I said, give us a facile tool that immediately allows us to plug and play and create vaccinations and manufacture them without going to the cells, without having to grow them, all of which take a lot longer to develop. And so this is about speed, it's about specificity, and it's about diversity of being able to use it for multiple different types of pathogens.
How do you keep up with it? I mean, the science of it, you as a medical doctor.
Yeah, it's someone said this before, it literally has been not just about the vaccines, but knowledge about all these different therapeutics. It's like drinking from a fire hose, right? Because, and it's not just the science, you know, as you know, Chris, I worked during the Ebola epidemic in West Africa, and my day job is dealing with emerging infectious diseases. And I know it's always hard because science is shifting. And in my position as someone who takes care of patients with emerging infectious diseases, this is always been a challenge. What's new, though, is just the volume at which this knowledge is arriving, and then the related ethical questions, the related public health questions, right? A perfect example now is that we might have a couple of different vaccine candidates over the next few months, some which have really high efficacy, but we don't have as many of those, and some that may have lower efficacy. And you have a lot more. So AstraZeneca is, you know, one vaccine that's shown about 70% efficacy. They released their data today as well. And so how do we come to terms with that? You know, what do we deploy where? When do we deploy it? And so it's the science, but it's also the all the other elements of it, the ethics, the distributive justice, everything else.
Seems to me the illustrative moment for everything is that transmission from a Chinese doctor of the fully sequenced genome of this virus from China on January 10th to the whole world. Instantly, it becomes a global laboratory, and all the best minds in biology were fixed on it ever since.
That's right. And that was a pivotal moment, because that's what allowed the engines of innovation, and not just for building therapeutics and vaccines, but it's also what allowed us to start creating the first generation of diagnostics. It really goes to show you, one of the criticisms that China got during the period of SARS was that they were not as forthcoming, and it took much longer. And over the last few years, my own experience with the other emerging infectious diseases, there's been a lot of discussion about the balance between sharing genetic diversity and pathogen sequences, as well as sovereignty. When you share a sample, sequence is one thing, but if you share a sample of a biological pathogen, you're also sharing information about the patient who had it, because you're sharing clinical samples. And a lot of countries have sort of balked at this idea of sharing biological information about populations. And where is the equity? Where is the ethics of that? How do we ensure that people who share sequences, particularly those from low-resource countries, receive some benefits from the types of therapeutics and medications and vaccines that are created out of that? And so this shows, again, the importance of us working globally. There's so much benefit for everybody, as long as we can ensure that there's some amount of equity in terms of rewards that come out of that research.
Back in 1960, James Watson and Francis Crick with the young giants of the new biology for their discovery of the double helix, that circular staircase strand of the DNA molecule carrying the genetic code of life. Matthew Meselson was their younger friend at Caltech, already a star in the Linus Pauling lab, working to fill out the story. He published what became a famous paper in the magazine Nature about the unstable intermediate, as he called it, between the genes and the proteins inside the cell. There had to be a messenger, and he knew it was RNA. You've seen a lot of science in a long lifetime, Matthew Meselson. Rate this among the breakthroughs or the big news that messenger RNA works to heal.
Well, in terms of applications, it's very important. It's like maybe, I don't know if it's exactly right to compare it with the discovery of penicillin, which was an accident, though. That's a little different. This was no accident. This was a deliberate program of research. It's very important. And other vaccines will probably be made this way. Now, however, I should emphasize, for a lot of things, vaccines are not the way to go. Because look at what we've paid already economically, in terms of people who died, in terms of people who became sick, even though they didn't die, in terms of all kinds of psychological costs. So let's say a new pandemic happens, a viral pandemic, and there are thousands and hundreds of thousands of different viruses in bats, in all kinds of wildlife. Sooner or later, we'll get another one. After all, we had SARS-1 only a decade ago, and before that, we had MERS. And before that, there was Ebola, although that got stopped. Now, my point is this. We don't have the Black Plague anymore, the one that wiped out half the people in Europe. It's not because anybody's vaccinated against Pasteurella pestis, the bacteria that causes plague. Nobody's vaccinated. Yep. It's that we've learned how to control rats and lice. In other words, hygiene. Now, in the case of viral diseases that are spread through the air, and by the way, the CDC and the WHO still have a problem with pointing out that it's spread mainly through the air. They haven't admitted it. It's a long story. Anyway, but the point is that if we begin to improve the air quality where people live, in big office buildings, in bars, in restaurants, in airplanes, it's not that hard. You put in a HEPA filter. That'll get rid of it. So little by little, just as we're changing the structure of our cities and buildings, as we approach not using fossil fuels, we should be modifying our air conditioning systems to give us cleaner air. And it would have great other benefits. People who have allergy problems, they'd be helped. Future pandemics would be stopped dead in their tracks if they're viral. Whereas if you had to do this each time, every 10 years, another year like this year, the world economy couldn't stand it.
Matthew Meselson is 90 now, staying abreast of his field and still teaching at Harvard. Thanks also to Nahid Bedelia and Derek Rossi. Please think of supporting Open Source by becoming a monthly subscriber on Patreon, where you'll find a growing audio library of conversations about literature, politics, and a lot more. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies and Adam Coleman. Max Liebman engineered. Mary McGrath is our life messenger. I'm Christopher Leiden. Join us next time. Join us every time for Open Source.